The Katra Foundation presents the Katra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're getting into the life of someone many of you probably know, Dame Agatha Mary Clarissa Christie.
The Queen of Crime.
Exactly. We know the Poirot, the Marple. But maybe the most intriguing puzzle she left behind was her own life story.
What she tells sort of in her own way in an autobiography published after her death.
Right. And it's key to understand. This isn't like a diary. She worked on it for what, 15 years?
Yeah, over 15 years. And it's very much a curated self-portrait. It's warm, yes, conversational, but also highly selective. She valued her privacy immensely.
So the book really emphasizes what mattered to her travel, her craft, and this incredible, almost stoic resilience.
Pragmatic endurance. She seemed to embody that.
That's exactly the phrase. And that's our mission today, isn't it?
Yeah.
To get beyond just the what happened and understand the why. Why was she so resilient? Where did that creative genius really come from?
We want to find those origins, the roots of that strength, especially when she faced, well, significant personal tragedy later on.
Okay, let's dive in. And like with so many stories, we have to start at the beginning. Her childhood, what she called a near-perfect Eden.
That's right. Ashfield, her childhood home in Torquay, Devon. Born Agatha Miller in 1890 into a comfortable upper-middle-class life.
But her education, or lack thereof initially, was pretty unusual, largely thanks to her mother, Clara.
Clara Bomer. She had this, well, almost radical idea for the time that formal schooling, if started too young, could actually spoil the brain.
Spoil the brain. So Agatha was kept home.
Yes. Apparently, she only learned to read when she really insisted, around age 5. Think about the effect of that, though. Years of unstructured freedom.
Just inhabiting her own mind.
Pretty much. It forced her, you could say, to develop this incredibly rich inner world. Her first companions were imaginary friends. Her first stories were entirely in her head.
So that inner Ashfield, as you put it, that was like her first apprenticeship in creating characters, figuring out plots.
Exactly. It was all internal observation, internal discipline, not performing for anyone.
Which is fascinating because her first real ambition was performance-based, wasn't it? Music.
Yes. She went to Paris, studied singing and piano, really aimed for a professional career.
But it didn't work out. Stage fright.
Crippling stage fright, apparently. She just couldn't perform in public, so that artistic door slammed shut.
Which, thinking about it, maybe pushed her towards writing. The ultimate private art form.
I think that's a really insightful way to see it. That failure was a pivot. Writing allowed her to control narratives, manipulate characters. You know, ultimate control, but from the safety of her desk, away from the spotlight she feared.
So that inner world, honed in childhood, found its outlet. But what actually sparked the detective writing career? It wasn't quite so profound, was it?
Huh. No, not really. It was actually a dare, a bet with her older sister, Madge.
Her sister bet her she couldn't write a detective story where the reader couldn't guess the killer.
That's the story. A bit of sibling rivalry, maybe, but it was the starting pistol.
Okay, so the impulse was there. But the tools she needed, especially her signature weapon, poison, that came from somewhere much more serious.
World War I. That experience was absolutely fundamental. She started as a volunteer nurse, which was, you know, incredibly demanding work.
Grueling, I imagine.
Definitely. But the really crucial part for her writing came later when she worked as a dispenser in a hospital pharmacy.
Right. Handling medicines, compounds.
Exactly. And this wasn't just casual. She was dealing with regulated substances, precise dosages, day in, day out. This gave her this deep, practical, hands-on knowledge of poisons.
Her professional university for murder, as you said. Not just theoretical knowledge.
Not at all. She knew the effects, the timing, the subtleties. It gave her mysteries and authenticity that really set them apart. Poisons became her signature, used with clinical precision.
And that detailed, methodical work in the pharmacy, it almost mirrors the plotting she became famous for later, doesn't it? Structure imposed on creativity.
That's a great connection. And that knowledge fed into her first novel, The Mysterious Affair at Stiles. It introduced Hercule Poirot, inspired by Belgian refugees, she'd seen.
Yes. But it wasn't an instant success, was it? Lots of rejections first.
Oh, definitely a struggle. Rejected multiple times before it finally got published in 1920.
But the real game changer, the one that made everyone sit up and notice her genius and caused a bit of an uproar, was the murder of Roger Ackroyd in 1926.
Oh, yes. Ackroyd. That book was well, revolutionary for the genre at the time.
Because of the twist ending, it really broke the mold.
Completely. It fundamentally played with the reader's trust, the implicit contract between author and reader in a whodunit. She followed all the rules, closed circle, clues, red herrings, but then used the reader's own assumptions against them.
So it wasn't just clever, it was subversive.
Absolutely. It established her as a master manipulator, someone who could push the boundaries of the very form she was helping to define, made her a huge name.
But 1926, that year was also pivotal for her personally, wasn't it? And not in a good way.
Tragically so. It seems almost cruel how professional triumph coincided with personal devastation. 1926 was, by all accounts, the absolute darkest period of her life.
Her mother died, who she was incredibly close to.
Yes, the loss of her beloved mother. And then, almost immediately after, her husband, Archie Christie, confessed he was having an affair and wanted a divorce.
Wow. Grief and betrayal, one after the other.
It led to what we'd now probably understand as a severe psychological breakdown.
And this brings us to that really striking thing about the autobiography, the huge omission.
The 11-day disappearance, yeah.
I mean, this was a massive news story at the time. Hmm. National headlines, searches, speculation. She was famous by then.
A huge sensation. Yet, in an autobiography, she barely touches it. She mentions the unhappiness surrounding the divorce, but the disappearance itself, almost complete silence.
What does that tell us about her philosophy?
It speaks volumes about her fierce need for privacy. It's like she refused to let that period of intense vulnerability and public scrutiny define her narrative. She walled it off.
Which feels, I don't know, almost radical today in our era of tell-all memoirs and, you know, constant self-exposure.
It really does. She decided that her pain was hers alone, not for public consumption. But what she did next is just as telling about her character.
She didn't just retreat.
No. Her response was action. Pure, decisive action. She basically, on an impulse, booked a solo ticket on the Orient Express.
The Orient Express. Just like that.
Just like that. Apparently, she was initially aiming for the West Indies, but changed her mind en route and ended up heading towards Baghdad.
That's incredible. Her life is in ruins, and her instinct is geographic cure. Go somewhere completely different.
Change the scene. Change the story. It was a profound act of self-reinvention, a physical pivot away from the wreckage.
And that journey, that impulse, led to her second act.
It absolutely did. It opened up a whole new world for her, quite literally, on a subsequent trip to the archaeological dig at Ur in Mesopotamia.
She met Max Mallowan.
Yes, Max Mallowan. An archaeologist 14 years younger than her.
Which must have raised a few eyebrows back in 1930.
Oh, I'm sure it did. But their connection was deep and immediate. They married in 1930, and it was a partnership that lasted the rest of her life.
A really supportive one, it seems. He respected her work, her need for quiet.
Completely. It was this wonderful balance. She kept up her incredible writing output, but also embraced this whole other life as an archaeologist's wife, traveling to digs, assisting him.
Which, of course, gave us fantastic settings for books like Death on the Nile, Appointment with Death, Murder in Mesopotamia.
Exactly. Those exotic locations weren't just fantasy. They were drawn from her own experiences alongside Max.
And she had that famous quip about him, didn't she? About archaeologists.
Yes, the classic line. An archaeologist is the best husband a woman can have. The older she gets, the more interested he is in her.
Perfect. Sums up the affection and the wit.
It really does. And looking at her whole life, especially how she navigated 1926 and found Max, you can really see that core philosophy of pragmatic endurance crystallizing.
It's about order, common sense, just getting on with things.
Yes, not dwelling, not wallowing. When adversity strikes, pivot, change the scene, return to work. That seemed to be her formula.
And that pragmatism flowed right into her writing process, too. She didn't really romanticize it, did she?
Not at all. She compared plotting to intricate cabinet making, methodical, detailed work, no waiting around for bolts of inspiration.
And that famous anecdote, plotting in the bathtub.
Yeah.
Eating apples.
Yes. It's such a charming image, but it speaks to her process. She would let the plot elements, victim, suspects, motive, method, just sort of compost in her mind.
While doing everyday things.
Exactly. Walking, washing dishes, lying in the bath. She worked out the entire puzzle internally, every twist and turn, before she wrote a single word down.
That level of mental discipline is just astounding.
It really is, and the results speak for themselves. Best-selling novelist of all time, billions sold, over 100 languages.
She basically perfected the classic whodunit formula. The closed circle of suspects, the red herrings, the least likely person.
And gave us Poirot and Marple, these enduring archetypes. Her impact on the genre is just immense.
And she seemed to find real peace later in life, didn't she? Reflecting on it all.
She did. She's spoke of enjoying her second blooming greatly, finding it much better than the strident, noisy time of being young. A sense of contentment earned through that endurance.
Okay, so let's distill this down. We've journeyed through her life, the highs, the lows, the writing. What are the key human lessons here for you, the listener?
Right, the takeaways.
Let's start with an emotional insight. For me, the most powerful thing is that catastrophic loss, that devastation like she felt in 1926. It doesn't have to be the end of your story.
Mm-hmm. Her second act, finding love with Max, embracing archaeology. It shows that a later chapter can actually be richer, more fulfilling than what came before. A second blooming is possible.
Okay, now for an intellectual insight. What's the key takeaway from her work, her process?
I think it's about cultivating that inner world, that inner Ashfield. Find your own unique creative process, even if it seems eccentric, like plotting in a bathtub.
So discipline married with whatever works for you.
Precisely. It's about deep observation, internal preparation, finding your own methodical magic, whether you're writing a novel or solving a problem at work.
And finally, a universal insight, the most practical life lesson we can take away.
For me, it comes back to that Orient Express moment. Resilience isn't just a feeling you wait for, it's an action.
When things fall apart, you don't have to feel strong to act strong.
Exactly. Take a step, any step. Change the scene, change your routine, do something decisive, however small. That physical pivot can be the most powerful antidote when you feel stuck in despair. Action over feeling sometimes.
Yeah, it's really powerful.
And maybe one final thought, circling back to that glaring omission, her silence about the disappearance. In our time where sharing vulnerability is often seen as strength, Christie's fierce protection of her private pain is, well, it's provocative.
It makes you think, doesn't it?
It does. Her legacy suggests that maybe, just maybe, the real power in owning your story sometimes lies in deciding what not to share, choosing what remains yours alone.
A life of mystery, certainly, but also one of incredible quiet strength, meticulous craft, and that pragmatic endurance. Maybe next time you pick up a Christie novel, you'll see a bit more of the remarkable woman behind the puzzle. Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.